Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast that wouldn't even be mildly surprised by a sudden Dalek invasion right now. Bring it on, 2020. I'm Nathan.
I'm James.
I'm Peter.
And I'm Todd.
Well, it's the end of the world, which is now an honoured tradition at this time of year, but it's the end of the world like you've never seen it before. Every spin-off, every companion, and nearly every mum turn up to say goodbye to David Tennant's Doctor 18 months too early. It's an all-singing, all-dancing, apocalyptic extravaganza. It's The Stolen Earth. So we hit Earth running. We've come straight from the end of the previous episode, and we land in a street where the last ever milkman in Britain is delivering milk.
Who gets milk delivered these days? Who?
Carton.
I think it's very definitely, you know, just an attempt to do sort of suburban normality. But all I could think of was John Pertwee driving the float for his old dad.
I think Russell missed a comeback there for old Jones the milk.
I just got survival. I was expecting a Kitling to kidnap that milkman at any second.
Yes, of course. I'd forgotten the milkman in survival. I think that this is a really, really well-structured scene.
I think it's brilliant. I mean, the entire pre-credit sequence is just, I mean, could you ask for anything more perfect than that?
Yeah. So it starts with the milkman, and then we get, you know, the Doctor and Donna arriving. We get Earth disappearing from underneath them, and then we get these sort of three plot threads, don't we? The two spin-offs and Martha.
Martha starts it off.
Yeah.
And then we go to Captain Jack and them in Torchwood, then to Sarah Jane, and then back to Wilfred and Sylvia. They always want the women.
Yeah.
and then Rose with her big gun. I mean, and she gets to look up at the sky and we get to see, you know, a gazillion planets, and it's the Marvel's crossover event we never knew we wanted or needed, you know. It's just incredible.
It is sort of it's the story of Doctor Who, isn't it? It's Doctor Who, the spin-offs. And Martha.
Don't worry, Big Finish will make one for her soon.
Well, I think the amazingly clever thing about it is that it's circular, that every one of the little inset scenes have a character being encouraged to look at the sky, but we don't get to see what's in the sky until Rose turns up and we see it from the milkman's point of view. So we start and end on the milkman and on that massive reveal, which is just, it's bonkers. I mean, it is unbelievable, you know, to have the Earth moved out of position. I mean, there's a lot of competition, you know, every single series finale has been huge and has had to sort of outdo the previous one. And I think at the time people expressed sort of reservations about that or thought it was tiresome or whatever, but I'm absolutely on board with it, you know, make it huge. And they do. It's mental.
It's fantastic. It's the Doctor Who cinematic universe coming together. And Russell's ahead of his time on this. He's sort of assembled the whole team and he throws in everything else. He throws in, we've got Harriet Jones and Davros and the Daleks and the most seismic event in the Doctor Who universe, which is a regeneration. We've got all that to come in this episode. And you know it's special just from the pre-credits teaser and from those endless names swooping past in the opening titles. It's wildly confident. And I think only a series and a writer at the top of their game could even attempt to pull this off.
I agree. And over the course of these two episodes, every single semi-regular character is basically either in it or name-checked.
Yeah.
And the fact, it says volumes, the fact that they can get back all these people back to the show and they're willing to come back and do these episodes when obviously some of them have very busy schedules. I think it's amazing.
Yes, and this show made stars of these people. That's why they're busy.
Well, also, yeah. I mean, Rose is almost not in it. They had scheduling issues. They had to move the schedule about quite a lot because she was on her honeymoon when this was due to be filmed. And they almost had to rewrite her out of it.
In fact, I think she got married while Russell was writing one of these episodes, and Russell actually bailed on her wedding.
Yes.
Because the writing of it was so sort of enormously complex. Mm. And Russell was reaching the end of 4 years of just an incredible amount of work.
Yeah, and he got sick as well. So,
yeah.
Yeah, he skipped out of the wedding and something else as well, like a holiday with his husband or something. Like, he had to cancel everything, like, at the last minute to get this finished.
You know, I'll be a little bit controversial and say that I think if Rose had been written out of this, it might have made it a better story. Ooh. And that's not a judgment. That's not a judgment on Billy at all. I love Rose and I love Billy, and it's great to see them back. But Rose's story was in some ways completed, and I think this diminishes the character a little bit.
I think we'll get onto that next week because I agree with you a little bit, but I do like the fact that in this episode, Rose is sidelined and she discovers that since she's gone, the Doctor has built up this huge network of people who, you know, love him and care about him, and she's on the outer. That Zoom call that they have.
Her reaction to Martha, who are you?
Well, it's good to see that she hasn't changed to tune. She's still a stroppy little self-centered so-and-so. But it's all done with humour, and I think that's so great is that she is building up this antagonism towards Martha in a lot of the things that she says. So I think former companion to the Doctor, oi, so was I, like things like that. I think there's a payoff next week when they do finally meet.
Yeah.
And this episode is just, I'm just going to put it on the table now. The three episodes, this is the third episode in a row, which I would give more than 10 out of 10 to. Like, from Midnight, Turn Left and this are just, I don't think they're surpassed in classic or new Who.
Are we talking 10.2, 10.3?
Or did you turn it up to 11?
No, it's 11 out of 10. But these three episodes, honestly, that's how I feel. And I just think it's just extraordinary. All the build up through this, and you're wanting Rose to meet obviously meet the Doctor, and you know that's not going to happen until, you know, the bitter end, but it's just the anticipation and everybody slowly meeting each other.
Yeah. Well, that was always the thing that we fantasized about as kids as well. And I think there were new adventures that kind of touched on this, the idea that there were people on Earth, you know, living at the same time who had traveled with the Doctor, and we imagine them kind of meeting one another. And here it gets to happen, you know, that because it's modern TV rather than classic Doctor Who, where such a thing just would never have been possible. Like, I guess we get the Brigadier back in Mordred Undead, but by then sort of Doctor Who's eating itself a bit. Here you have people who are invited back for sort of guest roles, and we love it. We love it. And the thing that Russell has done, the big triumph of these 4 years is to take a show that fights against the creation of a coherent world, a show where every episode is set in a different time and place, where every episode has a different tone. And it creates a coherent world not by bringing the Cybermen back to do their greatest hits or by constantly referencing previous stories, but by having these characters, you know, a whole cast of characters. The Doctor has a group of friends who are all really well drawn, who we really like. And we get to see them slowly coming together in his absence. And in a way, it's like the Christmas Invasion, only on a small scale, because, you know, the Christmas Invasion sidelines the Doctor and relies on the fact that we have Harriet Jones and Jackie and Mickey and Rose, and that we love them and care about them and enjoy watching them. And we're willing to wait for the Doctor to turn up. And so, you know, the Doctor's role in this episode is really sort of fairly minimal, isn't it?
Well, it's that kind of journey to the Shadow Proclamation, which is maybe the least successful part of the episode.
Yeah, I think he had a much, much bigger scale thing in mind for the Shadow Proclamation.
He did, didn't he? Like, he, when I was reading the writer's tale, the list goes on and on and on. He wanted to bring back every CG monster they'd ever created and get all the prosthetics out as well. And he was going to bring back baby Margaret Slitheen.
So there is actually a big cartoon that he does of his version of the Shadow Proclamation, because he's a very skilled cartoonist. And so he draws that version of the Shadow Proclamation, and it's included in the writer's tale. It's really great. And so that was going to be huge, and it does end up being a little bit crap.
I would agree that it, because what you get is you get the woman with the red eyes and her offsider who likes to have visions of the future, or a trope that he uses next year where everybody can talk about what's going to happen to a certain character or situation. And then you've got the Jadoon in the background, and you know, what's the name of the woman in charge of the Shadow Proclamation?
I think her name is Madge Proclamation.
I think her name is the Shadow Architect.
No, she's Madge Proclamation. Otherwise known as Frizzy Whitehair, what's her name?
She's from a long line of Madges.
Madge
is actually not so bad, and I do enjoy that scene where
not
the
so
Doctor
good
and
either.
Donna. No, but that scene where the Doctor and Donna, and particularly Donna, work out what's going on. So they've detected like 24 missing planets or 23 missing planets, and Donna, because she's clever, remember, works out, you know, what the missing planets are, and then we see the Doctor work out what they're for. And her line about I'm a human and I'm just as important as a Time Lord is super important to the plot as well.
Yeah. But I like all the pomp and all the froth, should I say, like, you know, if you're having coffee, all the icing, like, you know, talking about all these planets that we've seen, like, or not seen, like the Adipose breeding planet, the lost moon of Poosh. They talk about Calufrax Minor.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just wonderful. And then, you know, relating things to the bees. And so, although the Doctor is somewhat obviously sidelined, a lot of the dialogue I actually really enjoy in those scenes. Like, there's sprinkling of things that just make you smile, or there's payoff. You know,
yeah.
Even if that woman at the end declares that they're going to declare war right across the universe, and then what does she do? Just sit there and do nothing, because they never turn up.
Yeah, keep your frizzy white hair on, Madge.
I actually think that that's the Doctor rejecting the role that he had in the Time War. That we're about to sort of see the Time War start again, and the Doctor puts a stop to it. Like, he just says, nope, I'm not going to do that. And that's important for next episode. You know, the way that this story resolves itself involves a rejection of that kind of thing. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
And it's also not a grandstanding moment for the 10th Doctor. He just says, I'm just going to go over here now. And that's how he gets out of it. We also get Donna's side eye when the Doctor speaks Jadoon. That's worth the price of entry alone.
Let's see, another wonderful comic moment. I think Doctor Who is at its best when there's so much comedy within so much tension, within so much action. You know, that is the joy of Doctor Who. Unlike other things that take themselves so seriously, it's the comedy in these situations that are dire.
Absolutely.
And that's absolutely Russell's strength. He can just pivot between sort of drama and comedy and tragedy and farce just like that. He's so clever at it, and he does it so well. And a lot of the reason that we love the characters is because they're funny.
I think it may be the single biggest difference between the third series and the fourth is that you have Martha, who's perfectly good character, but she doesn't bring a lot of comedy, whereas Donna does, and it just elevates things slightly.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think this story clearly has one aim, and that's just to be event television. The point is that it's an event. It doesn't set out to be the best piece of Doctor Who ever, regardless of whether it turns out to be or not. The only equivalents I can think of in the history of the show are the Five Doctors and maybe the Dalek invasion of Earth. They set out to be events for the audience. And I think you could only do it at this point with the show at like an apex of popularity, you need kind of an enthusiastic, receptive audience to be able to deliver this to them. You need them to be active participants.
And an audience that has been sort of properly watching it for all of this time, or at least aware of it. Even if you'd kind of dipped in and out, even if you weren't a committed fan, you would know about Rose and Martha and Donna, and they would have been on the telly, and there are news stories about them. You've got Bernard Cribbins, you know, you've got Mums, all of these minor characters that people remember. You know, Harriet Jones is huge in a Christmas special, which was watched by, you know, how many people, 10 million people or whatever. You just can't do it otherwise. And if you compare it, I think The Five Doctors is the nearest equivalent. And if you compare it to The Five Doctors, you know, Liz Shaw is in it or whatever, and kind of like, we love Liz Shaw, but frankly, who cares? Whereas this has earned the right to do all of this stuff. And all of the little kids who are watching Sarah Jane Adventures get to see Luke and Sarah Jane. They get that moment, the first moment when it's made clear that Mr. Smith's fanfare is diegetic, that it can be heard by the people in the room and isn't just added in post-production. It's so great. And the people who are watching Torchwood get to see, you know, after that horrible, horrible finale where Tosh and Owen are killed, now you get them back in a sort of fun, silly Doctor Who story with Yanto doing jokes and all of that sort of thing.
It's hilarious that you compare it to The Five Doctors because, like, I mean, who would be the Richard Herndl character? Like, I kind of think they couldn't have got Billy Piper. Maybe they could have got the Doctor's daughter back for that role. Do you know what I mean?
That's true. Or told they could have just recast it with Sonya. I mean, yeah, those are curious. I think the relationship with the audience is key to these episodes. And you talk about sort of kids watching and having, you know, these kids would have had like action figures, which they would have brought, and they would have put characters together. They would have had Donna and Rose and Jack having a scene together, or they would have had Rose hanging out with Wilf and Sylvia. And we get all of that here. We get that kind of mixing up of the characters.
Well, Russell actually described his creative process with this story as, I wanted this to be something the kids would play in the playground. I wanted this to be a crossover that a child would make with their action figures.
Did he say that? Oh, okay. I hadn't read that. But yeah, no, you definitely get that.
But all the characters get their moments. Like having Liz Sladen react to Exterminate first,
yes,
I think is just marvellous because it's for us classic fans, we know this, but for the new people watching it as well, it's like, oh, she knows about them. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just ties in little plot points like that, you know? The Doctor says someone tried to move the Earth once before. Like, it's a throwaway line, but, you know, I thought it was Dalek invasion of Earth, but Peter, you were saying before that you thought it was more the mysterious planet, like, you know?
Well, that was the first thing that occurred to me. I mean, it makes sense to be Daleks in context of the story.
In fact, we get the Dalek music before the opening credits, before we know that the Daleks are involved. We get the Dalek music when we see the shot of the planets for the first time. Let's talk about the Daleks because, I mean, this is the best that they've ever been, I think, and they haven't been as good as this since then, ever. So you get Dalek saucers, you know, attacking New York, flying down Broadway.
Exterminate, you know. Torchwood.
What are they, fans? They're upset fans. Russell wanted to destroy New York in one of the scripts. In one of the drafts of the script, Russell was planning to destroy New York, but then went, maybe that'll stuff up series 5 for Moffat.
But also, perhaps, given that this is 2008, it's perhaps not in the best possible taste. But you can see why they do it, because he's already established that New York is a city that gets rebuilt and rebuilt and rebuilt, you know, and that exists as a kind of symbol of humanity for billions of years. So you can sort of tell that he's toying with it, and that's clearly why Martha's there, because New York is important.
Yeah, it's such a shame, however, that, like, you don't have familiar unit characters there to be killed off, like that fool who's in charge of unit back in the two-parter earlier in the season.
I mean, Colonel Mace.
Yeah, Colonel Ginless.
He deserved to be exterminated.
Well, in fact, they get someone much better and much more interesting to play the lead in unit. And that scene with Martha where she's on the phone to Jack, it's just wonderful. She's on the phone to Jack. She's been in Torchwood for a few episodes. He makes a sort of sly reference. Voice of a Nightingale is a reference to series two of Torchwood, where she does, what, three episodes? Mm-hmm. And having him talk to her while she's sort of making this decision, having General whatever his name is kind of say, you answer to me, you don't answer to Torchwood, having Jack begging her not to use the Indigo Project, all of that stuff, there's such a scale to it, and it is just what we would have wished would happen, you know.
Has that got to be a joke of Russell's calling it the Indigo Project, because it was salvaged from Sontaran Hardware? And for some inexplicable reason, that two-parter is bathed in purple light.
That was deliberate, yes.
Oh, was it? I think it's amazing having the Daleks involved and seeing everyone's reaction to them, because it's a reminder of just how woven into the fabric of Doctor Who that the Daleks are. So Sarah was there at their creation. Jack was killed by them. Martha's thinking back to her terrifying encounter with the Dalek cloaca in a pinstripe suit. The individual reactions to the Dalek voice are superb because they're the audience reaction. It's every time you have a first night with the Daleks in the old series. It's every time you know that they're coming back for a season finale in the new series.
Yeah. People were complaining at the time that there were too many Daleks. We have Daleks in 3 out of 4 of Russell's series finales. And I just kind of think that's like saying, like, too much chocolate, or, you know, like, too many martinis. It's absurd. You know, you're watching Doctor Who. There's Daleks in it. Remember those long stretches where we had no Daleks at all? And sure, you know, that allowed people to explore and do other things. But the show hasn't been short of creativity for the last 4 years. And the Daleks here are magnificent. And they take so many cues from Dalek Invasion of Earth, don't they? Even catchphrases.
The Descendants.
Yes, the males, the females, the Descendants, you know. we are the masters of Earth. All of that stuff. It's just classic 60s Daleks, only on a massive budget. It's so good.
And on that level, I mean, the most meta that the story could possibly be, having Wilf fighting the Daleks after having fought them on the big screen in the 60s.
So, you know, that was actually a suggestion. The paint gun scene was a suggestion by Bernard Cribbins to Russell.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, I think it would be great if I got to shoot a Dalek, because it was a reference. Like, he wanted a reference to his original story.
Huh.
And then he ad-libbed that line about swapping the BFG with Rose as well.
But also, my vision is not impaired.
Yes.
So good. So brilliant. And even just the look of it, because you think he's done it, and then, you know, the paint sort of bubbles off and starts sort of dropping away. Like, it just looks so good.
It's the Daleks' reactions. It's their relationships with each character. Even Harriet Jones, they have a relationship with. Harriet Jones, yeah. Former PM. Yes, we know who you are. Russell must have written that at 3 o'clock in the morning, chortling away to himself.
And there is a sort of slight crap homespunness to the Daleks. They're definitely aliens conceived of in the 1960s by Terry Nation. And the show doesn't hide away from that. You know, Dalek in series one tried to create them, recreate them as a credible threat, you know, as something really truly terrifying. And so the script upgrades the Daleks there. But once you have sort of 200 ships and thousands of Daleks, they can afford to be a bit cheesy and sort of lean into the show's history. And I just think it's wonderful. Daleks do not accept human apologies. You know, it's so good. And Attack Pattern 7. Remember Dalek Attack Pattern 7? There's that family that refuses to stay out on the street that wants to go back into the house, and the guy throws a brick and the family all goes inside. And they go, Dalek Attack Pattern 7. And Dalek Attack Pattern 7 is clearly just three Daleks standing in a line. and then they blow up the house. And it's so great. It's so superb.
But I like the fact that he adds a new element to it, which of course is the creator, Davros. And I have to wonder at the time what New Who fans actually thought of the person in the shadows. What is this person in the shadows? And then actually seeing it for the first time, you know, with no reference really to it before. For us, it's like, you know, we know who that is, and oh my goodness, what a performance. But with no previous reference, is it an element that adds to the story for people who've only known New Who? It's just a question.
So there's an oblique reference to Davros in Dalek, and I think there's an oblique reference in the Dalek two-parter in Series 3 as well to, you know, them having a creator and so on. And so maybe New Who people have that. But remember that Davros, I think, is huge. He's one of the mythic things that classic Doctor Who created.
He's rooted in popular culture along with the Daleks, the Cybermen and the Master. It's those three and Davros from the original series.
And we've said this before, Russell reintroduces the Daleks in Series 1, the Cybermen in Series 2, the Master in Series 3 and Davros in Series 4. And so he brings to New Who all of that mythology, not all at once. It's not the opening speech of the TV movie. he holds his fire and brings them out in order so that New Who owns it as much as we do.
I did just question at the time whether certain people would actually know what that is. You know, obviously there's so much other fanfare going on. It doesn't matter if one element doesn't quite work for somebody, but it's just something that has always been a question in my mind.
I think the dialogue makes it very clear eventually that, you know, who Davros is. And so having him, this mysterious, shadowy Dalek-like figure with that fabulous music from Murray, I think that works on its own terms.
And he's very physically distinctive, I think, Davros. So even if people hadn't watched the show and didn't really know who he was, they would recognize the image of him. I mean, he's not the Macra.
they were going to approach Terry Molloy to return at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And also they didn't give him a name they called him Dave Ross in the script.
Yeah, they were calling him Dave, I think, on set, Dave Ross. Just to sort of hide the fact that it was Davros coming back. Mm. I think that Julian Bleach is the best Davros.
Big call.
Yeah. Michael Wisher is turning in his grave.
I think Michael Wisher is very good, but the mask is nowhere near as good as the mask that Bleach gets. And so that means that Bleach gets to give like a proper performance. And what he nails is the two registers that Davros has, the sort of quiet, thoughtful, menacing sort of register, and the sort of huge shouty register as well. And because he's got a better mask, we can see inside his mouth, his face is more mobile.
The horrible teeth.
I know, yeah. And we sort of had them, didn't we, with Michael Wisher, but
they were just NHS teeth. Sorry, Michael. The big book of British smiles.
I like to think of the second register of Davros's voice as being his branded burgeration.
Yeah, well, I mean, they, you know, I think that Remembrance of the Daleks makes a very, very clear parallel between Hitler on television during the Second World War,
yeah,
and you know, Davros, the way that he shouts as well.
Mm. I'm sorry, I've been mispronouncing that. It should be Davros.
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 Davros is coming.
Davros.
we'll talk more about him next week, because I think that as we discover his plan and, you know, when we get him interacting with the Doctor in person, I think we get to see how genuinely good he is.
Mm. It's interesting how all of these separate sort of plot threads come together, with the Doctor and Donna being in the TARDIS and the trail stops dead, the Medusa Cascade, and the Doctor sort of gives up. It's a bit like Colin Baker in Vengeance on Varos, really.
Yeah, he's out of Zyton 7. He doesn't know what to do next.
Maybe Donna could have brought him the TARDIS manual and that would have set off a, you know, wonderful plot thread.
I'm not sure that that works, that scene, because the Doctor, you know, but I guess we want to make it clear just how sort of truly defeated he feels, or how big the threat is. And it also, of course, gives Catherine Tate the chance to sort of act against him while he's not doing anything. And, of course, she's as magnificent as she always is.
Yeah, it's building the scale of the threat, isn't it?
Mm.
Yes, it is. But that whole moment, you know, you then get Harriet Jones coming in, you get the subwave network, you get, you know, all that comedy stuff. She wouldn't let me have a webcam because they're naughty. I mean, that is just one of the most hilarious things ever. Yeah. Rose going off at, you know, Martha, and having the flashback with Martha, you know, with her mum. I mean, you came home at the end of the world. You came back to me. Thanks, Francine. It's always about you. I mean,
still a much more mellow version of Francine than we've seen.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. I mean, I like her a lot more. I still don't love her, but it's great to have that, you know, and I love the fact that the Subwave Network was created by the Mr. Copper Foundation, going back to the Christmas special. Like, it's a subtle little tie-in, but it's a payoff for everybody who's been watching to go, oh.
You know, Russell was actually planning to bring back the famous Miserable Bastard in this episode.
Yes.
And it was
a very begrudging corporation.
He was going to bring back Russell Tovey as a companion for this story as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he will get to bring Russell Tovey back at the end of next year or, you know, but he was really throwing everything he could possibly throw at the script. And working around availability and just kind of what was practical, you know, in sort of two inflated episodes.
But, James, what I love is the fact that Russell does have all these ideas about bringing back all these things, and he'll do a draft or whatever, and then something will not practically work, and you realize, no, that's not right, or that's not going to work in this instance, or it's just serendipity that they can't be brought back, and it sort of all just works out beautifully. For him, like there's just something magical about this time on the show where decisions are made, whether they be 2 or 3 years ago, and they're all paying off now, and he makes decisions in scripts or people aren't available, and it just works out, you know?
Mm. You know, Todd, talent will win out in the end. Russell is just supremely talented and makes it look easy.
Yeah. I think it's really well worth going back to the writer's tale and rereading the sections on this because all of this – just seeing him create and winnow ideas and reject things and be sorry that things don't work out and stuff, just having that incredible access to his creative process is really, really interesting, I think.
I think also you can underestimate the amount of creativity and wit is needed to pull off a story like this. I mean, it's television before its time, with kind of crossover universes and characters coming back and everything. J&T had a sense of this kind of thing way back in the 80s, but he didn't really have the wit to pull it off, or more importantly, the audience goodwill, I think, to pull it off. The only point where he ever really successfully made event TV like this was Earthshock. And I think that's because that was part of his only genuinely successful season of Doctor Who. So many writers and many showrunners could have attempted this. I think very few could have pulled it off.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think Stephen Moffat is a supremely talented writer and, you know, someone that we're very lucky to have had in charge of the show for so long. He's written more Doctor Who on screen than anyone else at all. But this is not what he's interested in, and it's not playing to his wheelhouse. And for me, I've said before so many times that I feel sad about a version of Doctor Who that's just the Doctor and a companion, and they have no friends and they don't exist in a world. And Russell has just made something so spectacular that the show hasn't properly attempted to get, maybe a little bit in the Chibnall era, to try and give the show a sort of Earthbound context. And I think that that's what the show needs. It's like the UNIT era, only writ large.
Absolutely. It's Doctor Who as family, and the audience are willing participants in that. We're all part of the family.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like fandom, actually, but it's extended to the general viewership.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was it. They all got invited in to enjoy our thing.
And people who are down on Russell for being populist, I think, miss the fact that that was the point. It was inviting everybody in.
It was a Saturday night family drama on a mainstream broadcast channel. It needs to be populist entertainment. And that's the point that, although I really love a lot of what Moffat did, he's making it for the fans. After Series 5, it's being made for the fans. And, you know, Chibnall attempted to do that again in Series 11, but, you know, probably went too far and then went completely in the opposite direction the next season.
I think there is a midpoint to be charted there. I mean, I understand that there are arguments from some people who say that Russell was too populist. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I understand where it's coming from. I think there's a midpoint to be charted, and I think Moffat did actually get that quite right for a couple of seasons. But there's no denying Russell's instincts here. His instincts are correct.
And also when he decides to kill off one of our semi-regulars in Harriet Jones, there has to be some sort of price to pay. You know, he's not going to kill off certain people at this point in time. And to have it be her and not see it but hear it, you know, the way it's written and structured is just brilliant. Like, you feel it.
That. No. Russell, she's not dead. She dropped through a trapdoor and escaped on a motorbike.
Russell secretly thinks that the fun thing about Russell's approach to the show is that he's a fan of his own version of Doctor Who in a way that we are. And so he makes jokes about Chancellor Flavia. And he has this theory, I think, again, in The Writer's Tale, isn't there a cartoon of Harriet Jones escaping the Daleks? So he's engaged with it on that same level. Obviously, Harriet Jones dies, and in part as penance for her destruction of the Sycorax at Christmas Day. But, you know, Russell is still having fun with his own show.
But he's left it so that, you know, they say exterminate. She could escape, right? Like, if you wanted to bring her back now, like some showrunner could say, well, she actually did escape. It's a bit like
Teleported where at the last minute.
it's a bit like Melrose Place, where they kill off Kimberly off screen and then she comes back half a season later with a wig and a big scar. Like, I mean, it's that sort of thing that he just knows when to leave things open enough that if you wanted to, Big Finish could come in and do 15 box sets of Harriet Jones.
You know, they probably will if they can get Penelope Wilton.
And James, you said she might have been teleported away. Nathan, did this not remind you there was just enough wiggle room to have Servalan in the teleport in Terminal, you know?
Oh, yes.
So, of course, with her extermination, the subwave network is transferred to Torchwood. We're all talking to the Doctor at this point, aren't we? Or we're all about to talk to the Doctor?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that call goes through. And that's just a glorious moment where they're all on their phones, you know, trying to get the signal through to the Doctor, and then they're all appearing and, oh, who's that? And, oh, I mean, it's just...
You get that one front-on shot of Gwen typing away at the thing, which is used about five different times.
But when the Doctor finally comes in on the Zoom call, like, it is, it's so great, and he's so excited to see them all and so incredibly happy. And my favourite thing, and it comes up again next week, is that, of course, the thing that we all know about Jack is that he hits on people all the time. So he hits on Chantho, he hits on Martha in Utopia when he comes back. He hits on Sarah in this call, and Sarah really likes it. Like, she's, you know, sort of quite flattered. But he doesn't hit on Donna because Donna hits on him. Like, Donna is going, "Who's that?" and pointing to the screen and kind of doing sort of hilarious comedy, sort of sexy face on the call. And she will do that next week. Jack never hits on Donna because Donna is more sexually confident and more outgoing than Jack.
And then, of course, good old, you know, the doctor in that moment as well, of course, is sad that Rose is not there. And then and then something's coming through and you think, oh, could it be? But you know it's going to be Davros. And I'm so glad that Sarah even gets to react to just that, that you know. It's little touches like that that make the writing so good that she gets that moment in the midst of everything else.
And, of course, we'll have the utter fangasm payoff to that next week.
But, I mean, think about the Five Doctors. Do you know what I mean? Like, in the Five Doctors, at the very end, on the top floor of the tower, they're all there and, the Brigadier is there and all of these people who should be surprised to see one another and who never react to one another at all. But Russell doesn't let that happen here. And so having Sarah react, recognize Davros, and, you know, he decides that he has to make them interact in some way. Just as you said before, Todd, where it's Sarah who gets to hear about the Daleks first because, you know, she met them twice and met them in this incredible story from the 1970s, and then having her respond to Davros's voice and having Davros recognize her later. It's so good. I mean, it's so good. Without weighing it down, it didn't have to weigh it down. It didn't have to be something that you had to read a whole heap of Peter Haining coffee table books to understand.
I just love the fact that, yes, for classic series fans, it's there, but it's also a way of saying to New Who fans, well, come on, you need to come and watch some of these old stories. It's very subtle, and I really love the fact that's there.
And Russell knows his audience. He knows how to pick and choose. And so he's not referring to, you know, the Leisure Hive or Megalos. He's referring to possibly the most famous story from the original run, Genesis of the Daleks. So even the wider viewership is going to have some awareness of this fact, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, we've already heard about Sarah travelling with the Doctor. We had her give her laundry list of things that she'd encountered during her time with him. So even if you've only watched the new series, you're not going to be surprised that Sarah recognises the Daleks and Sarah recognises Davros's voice.
And, of course, all of that then runs into, you know, the Doctor having a bit of a confrontation with Davros, but then it's like, you know, I've only got one thing to say to you. Bye. So David Tennant, it's so cool. And it then just sets off the chain of events to the cliffhanger with everybody in peril.
I just think this cliffhanger is unbelievably great.
Amazing.
Yeah, like possibly the best one ever, but certainly up there. And so very early on in the episode, like in that sort of first scene in the TARDIS, where Donna says, but I know everything's terrible, but Rose's coming back isn't that good. And you see David Tennant, and for a second you wonder whether he's going to say, that's not important, it's all too dangerous or whatever. But he just is so genuine, you know, like Tennant is so artificial in his performance so often. But here he's just genuinely excited that he's going to see Rose again. And it's beautiful. It's so lovely. And again, Donna gets this incredible role in that scene where she appears and the Doctor's back is to her and Donna sees her first and she smiles in this subtle way.
Totally. And you know, when she says, ask her yourself, like, you know, the emotion in that and you can just, I just, you know, feel waves of emotion going over my whole person every time I watch that combined with Murray's music and that whole run, like, and the looks, and it's just this payoff.
Julie Gardner's talked about that, the fact that the Doctor running towards Rose is so big and romantic, the full-on pelt that he sort of puts on.
And it's the first thing that him and Rose ever do together is hold hands and run. You know, running is what they do, and it was what their relationship was about. You know, like many people, I sometimes found Rose and Tennant kind of irritating together in series two. And I think that was partly by design. I think, you know, Russell intended it. So I wasn't one of those people who sort of ship the Doctor and Rose in a sort of Tumblr kind of way. But nevertheless, I'm absolutely sold by the romance of that run. And just, of course, a Dalek comes and shoots him. Of course that happens.
It's Russell whipping the rug out from underneath us. Yeah.
But I love the fact that it's not a full-on extermination. It's a brush past, like, you know.
It hits one of his hearts.
And even when they come together, like when they, you know, he's lying on the ground, she's speaking to him, and it's like, hi, yes, I've been busy. You know, like the conversation is so normal and so delightful. I like your dental work. You know.
New teeth. Weird.
I think that whole sequence from the TARDIS touching down outside the church through to the end of the episode is one of the most perfect stretches of Doctor Who ever. It's beautifully written, it's beautifully performed, but let's not lose sight of how marshalled it is by Graham Harper. This story could have spun out of control so easily, and Graham Harper keeps it all perfectly in sync.
He is fantastic. Like, he is a perfect man for the job, especially in the TARDIS, when the TARDIS needs to have fire for God knows what reason coming up, you know, when they're trying to get back. You know, he does that so well. It's, thank God it's not, is it Douglas MacKinnon?
MacKinnon,
who directed the Sontaran two-parter. Thank God it's not him, because he's like who's that
Keith
fool?
Keith Boak of series four.
And I think you mentioned previously, James, or somebody did, he's like the Peter Moffat of classic series Doctor Who. We don't want him. Graham Harper is the right man for the job, and at every point in this, he just chooses the right shots, the right angles, the right performances.
And it's such a good script, but I think moving so seamlessly between so many plot elements is so much harder than it looks. It could have easily come off as a little bit of a mess, and yet it absolutely doesn't.
Perhaps the one thing I will say here at the end is that intercutting between all of the cliffhangers with Torchwood under attack, Sarah James seems to be getting exterminated for quite some time in her car. It's the one thing that I kind of go, okay, they're just going to keep on saying that for 5 minutes whilst other things happen. I can live with that.
I think you have to do that in the cliffhanger. Like, it's a good practice, I think, for all of the plot threads to come to a head at the same time. And they did it in their very, very first ever Keith Boak directed cliffhanger.
Let's just have a bit of compare and contrast between that and this.
Yeah, but I mean, even that, you know, it's a Russell script and a really great Russell script. And, you know, it doesn't quite come off, but it's the right instinct. And he does that here. So having Sarah confronted by the Daleks and Torchwood about to be attacked by the Daleks and so on. Like, all of this stuff happening at the same time is great.
I think Graham is just a confident, supremely confident director. He knows what he's doing, and so he knows when to pull out his bag of tricks, but he knows when to get out of the way as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the thing that's most striking about the difference between his stuff in the 80s and his stuff in the new series. The stuff in the 80s is so stylized and so artfully directed and stands out so much from everything else around it. Whereas, you know, he does use tricks. There are all sorts of fun, silly things that he does in The Unicorn and the Wasp that no one else has ever done in the new show. But he really just stands out because he's confident and competent, and not because he's trying to sort of to do arty moves with the camera so much. So, the other thing, the most incredible thing, we're at a point, I think, do we know David's leaving at the end of next year?
So we didn't know what was going to happen.
It was announced at the NTAs, wasn't it?
Yes, he announced at the NTAs, which was in October of that year, so about 4 months later.
So we do know by the time the next Doctor is airing, but we don't know it yet.
Yes.
We do know that Russell is leaving and that Moffat is taking over.
Yes.
So we have to be wondering what's going to happen with Tennant, I think, at this point. And so this cliffhanger, which is not just the Doctor in peril, because he's not actually. He's regenerating. He's going to be fine. We know that he's going to be fine. The cliffhanger is a cliffhanger because it puts us in peril in a way. Like, it's affecting us. What is going to happen next? What is going to happen to David Tennant's Doctor, who we adore? What's going to happen now?
He's breaking the rules of regeneration. Of course, there are no rules, but in our head canon, there are rules. Like, you just don't have the Doctor exterminated and regenerating unless he's actually regenerating into a new person.
Yeah.
But we're going to find something out next week. But at this point, some of us on this podcast, probably me, enraged that this is happening the first time round. How dare you do this with regeneration? You're wasting it if he's going to come back, regenerating him halfway through the story. This is absolutely appalling, but it's absolutely the best thing and the most wonderful thing coming back to it and watching it. It's just divine.
You know how sometimes people say it's just a massive pity that we know when the Doctor's leaving, and we've never seen a Doctor Who story in the new series where we haven't known that the Doctor's going to regenerate at the end and who the Doctor's going to regenerate into. Like, that just never happens and can't possibly ever happen again, because they announce the casting of a new Doctor. It's a big story. It's part of the whole program's paratext, is this discussion of who's going to play the Doctor next and when they're leaving and when they're joining. And so we can't have that again. But we get it here. You know, we get a surprise regeneration, and it's absolutely unbelievable. And when Moffat tries that trick again in his last season, it's horrible. But here, it's just so spectacular. It's just unimaginable. And it's, there's no, like, he cuts the thing right in the middle of the regeneration. It's not coming. It's not going to be thwarted. He's standing there in the TARDIS with the light pouring out of every orifice. You know, there's no stopping it now. We know it's happening. And then it goes.
There's no next time trailer either.
No, that's right. Yeah.
Do you think that's him making up for the fact that Eccleston ruined...
that's right, it's his, like, second bite at the cherry.
Yeah, so, like, you know, like, initially, you know, when they realized Eccleston wasn't returning, it was going to be a complete surprise. They weren't going to announce Tennant. He was just going to become him at the end of series one, and it was leaked.
Yeah, they almost pulled it off. The series was actually airing before it got leaked, so they came close.
Well, in fact, it got leaked, you know, between episodes one and two, didn't it?
Yeah. It goes back, I think, to what I was saying earlier about the fact that the audience is complicit in this. I don't think he can just throw in a regeneration like Moffat did in his last year and have it work. It has to be a big audience moment, which there, and between the Stolen Earth and Journey's End in the UK, where I was living at the time, with the regeneration cliffhanger, Doctor Who was everywhere. The Not We were talking about it in the office. There were endless news reports and interviews and TV discussion analysis. It was the genuine TV event that they tried to make it.
Yeah. It's just unthinkable, isn't it? Wonderful.
Yeah.
It's spectacular. And I think this cliffhanger is just astounding. And the whole episode is just a culmination of the past weeks and the past 4 years. And it really is just brilliant television.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. We'll be back next week for the first episode of the David Morrissey era, apparently, in Journey's End. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bondfinger and Jodie into Terror. Until next time, remember to look after the bees. Without them, the Doctor won't be able to save us from the coming apocalypse. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bilby, Nathan Bottomley, Peter Griffiths and James Selwood. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, Mr. Smith's Fanfare is Diegetic, was recorded on the 13th of April 2020 and released on the 31st of May. If you normally hit stop on your iPhone at this point in the podcast, you're missing out on several minutes of top quality content every week. So stay tuned now and you'll hear Peter and Nathan make an alarming admission. Okay, let's end it there, do you think?
Yeah.
That was good. That was good.
I didn't get to throw in my big character development surprise.
What was it? Give me a tag.
Okay. So talking about unexpected character development, Wilf is a Tory.
No, so this is the scene from years and years. So I read About Time's entry on this before we did it, and they read it differently, and I think they read it wrong. I think they read it that that Jackie's a Tory, and so when Wilf admits to voting for Labour, her response is, no, you didn't. But remember that scene in Years and Years where everyone goes to the polls, the general election, and Russell Tovey's character votes Conservative after being sort of super sort of liberal and terribly annoying and stuff? So I think it's a little sort of anticipation of that. I think that maybe he did vote Tory.
Well, you see, I think their reading of it, again, I agree with you, that's not accurate because he looks very chastened when Jackie says that to him. So this is my thinking. So he says he voted for Harriet Jones, who was definitely Labour because she was one of Blair's babes. Sylvie assures him, says he did not. So that means he voted Tory. And I mean, that's no great surprise since he lives in Chiswick, which is a Conservative hotspot in the borough of Britton Isleworth. It's just about conceivable that he voted third party, like Lib Dem or something. But if Harriet did win in a landslide, the Lib Dem vote must have collapsed. Ergo, Wilf is a suburban Tory.
Horrifying. I'll never
and
forgive
I'm totally
it.
Fine with that. Because that scene is just hilarious. Too. I just her
that's
reading
really
of that
funny,
scene,
isn't it?
You did not. Like whatever she says it, it's so good.
So good.
Well, they're so good. Like when that line you referenced earlier, Todd, where you know they always want the women. She could have reused her line. I know why you came to Earth, Davros. You think you'll meet a woman.
That just reminds me of that that episode of Ab Fab where Patsy is playing Booberella. She came to Earth to save womankind for herself.
I love Booberella.
Right. I do too. All right, here goes.